Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. First of all, I want to wish everybody a happy new year. I hope 2020 turns out to be a great year for you. This is a time when we tend to think about improving ourselves and our lives, right? We want to eat healthier, maybe work less, spend more time with the people we love, or at least spend less time staring at screens. But usually these are just ideas. And by February at the latest, we're back to doing things the way we've always done them. But what if a life-changing experience brings everything into crystal-clear focus, and suddenly you see a new path before you? That happened to David Fagenbaum.
So I nearly died 5 times over the course of a 3.5-year period after my diagnosis, and with each of those near-death experiences, I learned a lot about life and about living.
A mysterious illness struck David in 2010. He was 25 at the time and in med school. Previously, he had been perfectly healthy, now hospitalized for weeks.
I remember it being very dark. I remember being pretty confused. But I remember seeing the priest and knowing somewhere in my brain what this meant.
Lamb of God, you take away the sins of the world, have mercy on us. Lamb of God, you take away the sins of the world, have mercy on us. Lamb of God, you take away the sins of the world.
The doctors had not told me directly that this was it, but they had told my family that this was it. And seeing the priest was kind of my, like, recognition that this truly was it.
He was supposed to be dead, and the fact that he wasn't was a chance to squeeze just a little more life from whatever time he had left.
From the moment that I had my last rites read to me, I've realized that I'm living in overtime. And in overtime, there's this profound sense of focus. Everything has to be so intentional, and you can't, there can be no wasted movement, no wasted time. Every second truly has to count.
Every second has to count. Can you imagine that kind of focus? On today's show, we're going to hear from people who have a clear vision for their future. They know what they want and what they want to accomplish. For some of them, the new mission came after an illness or an accident. Others just decided to go after new goals. What can we learn from them? So for David, this idea that every second has to count was the first big lesson he learned from a near-death experience. Over the course of the next few years, he learned 4 more lessons in similar life-threatening situations. Liz Tung has more.
It took David Fagenbaum 11 weeks of sickness, including organ failure and a brush with death, before he finally got his diagnosis. His doctor was off that day, so a nurse practitioner delivered the news.
So she came in, handed me the report, said, "Good news, it's not lymphoma. I don't know what it is," and handed me the report.
It was Castleman's disease, a disorder so rare that neither she nor David, a third-year medical student, had ever heard of it. So we did what any of us would do in that situation. He started Googling.
The Wikipedia page only cited one paper, and it was from 1996. And basically it was saying nearly everyone would die within 2 years of diagnosis. And I knew I had a really serious disease. I mean, I was, like, very ill. But I just wasn't prepared to see statistics like that. And that was just terrifying.
Castleman's is what's called an orphan disease, meaning a disease that's so rare that drug companies have barely developed any treatments. It was first discovered in the 1950s, but even now, 70 years later, there's still a lot we don't know about it.
At its most basic sense, it's just the immune system becoming hyperactivated and then attacking your vital organs for an unknown cause.
In that sense, it's similar to an autoimmune disease, but it also has features of cancer, which has made it tough for researchers to classify. What they do know is that the prognosis for Castleman's is not good. That's especially true for the subtype David was diagnosed with, idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease, which of all the subtypes is the most rare, most deadly, and the trickiest to treat.
Because it's so poorly understood and because it's so deadly, doctors treat patients with chemotherapy because no one knows what to target. The immune system's out of control. Let's just kill the whole thing is basically the approach. It's kind of the atomic bomb nuclear option.
David's doctors had managed to treat his first flare-up using a strong dose of steroids. But when he relapsed again a month later, they opted for chemotherapy. At first, it worked well enough to stop his symptoms from getting worse. But David knew that if he wanted to survive this thing over the long haul, he'd need the help of a bona fide Castleman's expert.
We then learned that the world's expert was in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so I wasn't totally well, but I was well enough to know that I needed to get to Little Rock.
So David got in touch with the doctor, Fritz Van Rie, and made an appointment to see him in Little Rock. Remember, his doctors had managed to stabilize him using chemotherapy. But once David arrived in Little Rock, his Castleman's relapse got much worse.
Everything returns. The liver failure, kidney failure, bone marrow shutdown. But this time it's like even more aggressive than before.
It was the beginning of David's decline into his second big near-death experience. His condition was so serious that his new doctor, Fritz Van Rie, applied to the FDA for compassionate use of an experimental drug, a request that's only supposed to be granted to patients who are facing life-threatening diseases and have run out of options. The request was approved, and David started treatment. But still, his symptoms continued to worsen. Again, he could feel himself inching closer and closer to death. As he lay in his hospital bed, contemplating the possibility that he may be out of options, David took a quiet accounting of his 25 years of life. And he had a kind of epiphany.
I realized I didn't regret anything that I had done or I had said. I only regretted the things that I had not done or had not said and would not be able to do.
There was one regret in particular that was gnawing away at David. For the past few years, he'd been dating a girl named Caitlin. They were happy together. But when work and school had forced them to go long distance, they'd given up on the relationship without a fight.
And when we broke up, we both looked at one another and we said, you know, if it's meant to be, it'll work out. We've got all the time in the world. And then there I was, you know, dying in a hospital bed and realizing I didn't have any more time.
As he lay there, David made a resolution, what would become the second lesson from his second brush with death. He vowed to himself if he survived this, he would do his best to live a life without regret. Instead of going with the flow, he would seize on the things he wanted.
If I think about it, that I should do it. And so this is this concept or motto that I've taken with me, which is think it, do it. That, you know, don't think, oh, it would be great if we could be together, but not actually do the work, put the action in to actually make that a reality.
The experimental drug never ended up working for David, and he sank deeper and deeper into his illness. Finally, out of desperation, his doctors turned to a powerful chemotherapy treatment, the strongest he could tolerate. And it worked. It tamped down his overactive immune system just enough to lead him into remission. And as soon as he was feeling well enough, he got in touch with Caitlin and made his pitch.
The best part was is that I didn't have to fight too hard because she also really wanted to get back together, which kind of like surprised me. You know, there I was, this terminally ill patient, and she just didn't seem to care. Well, she cared, but it didn't seem to stop her.
David's third big lesson came on New Year's Eve of 2011. He was in the hospital recovering from another big Castleman's flare-up, his third, with the help of chemotherapy.
I was finally starting to feel well, and I still had a huge belly because my liver and kidneys weren't working. My head was bald from chemotherapy. I was wearing a mask because of the risk of getting an infection because I had no immune system.
It was a far cry from the mop-top, muscle-bound football player he used to be. But after three close calls, David was alive, and that's what mattered. So that New Year's Eve, David and his father decided to go on a walk around the floor of the hospital.
It's about 8 p.m., And as we passed by the family waiting area, we saw there was a guy who looked like he'd been drinking on New Year's Eve. He was kind of like swaying in his chair. And on our next lap, he had fallen onto the ground. And so my dad ran over and helped him back into his chair. And he looked at my dad and I, and he said, "Thanks so much. Good luck to you and your wife." I was like, "Wife? What is he talking about?" Then I looked at my belly and I realized he thought I was my dad's pregnant wife. And so I turned to my dad. I said, "You've got an ugly wife."
The two of them burst into laughter. David says it felt good, knowing he still had the capacity to laugh.
I think that if that had happened maybe a few months before, I don't know if I was quite ready to be able to laugh about that. I think I would have been like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe this drunk guy thinks that I'm my dad's pregnant wife. I like, you know, this is horrible." But like with all of the kind of the things I learned along the way and all of the like the low points, that became like funny. And that was like, that became like a high point amongst this like, you know, really, really tough time.
David says it wasn't just learning how to laugh things away. It offered a way of finding resilience, even control.
I think laughing in the face of death and disease is kind of the last thing that you think that you would want to do. But actually, it kind of gave me like a sense of like, I don't know if it was like power over the disease, that like, yes, disease, I know you're awful. I know you're killing me, and I know you're making me get chemotherapy, and you're even making me look like a pregnant woman. But I'm going to laugh, and like, I'm going to laugh with my dad. And this is going to be like, this is going to be something that we'll never forget, that time when this guy thought that I was, you know, my dad's pregnant wife. And it made me feel like I was like, even though the disease was clearly winning, it made me feel like I was like doing something to fight back, even if it was just kind of like, you know, kind of a mental exercise.
David spent another few months recuperating from relapse number 3 until eventually he felt well enough to go back to medical school. All things considered, David felt pretty good, but he knew how fragile his remission really was. In fact, there was only one thing standing between him and another relapse, an experimental drug called ciltuximab.
We hoped and prayed that it would keep me in remission. Even though it didn't work when I was sick, we thought maybe it could prevent a relapse.
But it didn't. After a few months of normalcy, the familiar, frightening symptoms of relapse returned. The fatigue and night sweats, abdominal pain, and organ dysfunction. By now, David knew what to expect. But this time was different.
It was one thing to be relapsing, but another thing to realize that this is it. This was like the only drug that was in development at the time for my disease, and that thing wasn't working.
David was scared, so he flew back to Little Rock to talk with his doctor.
I said, "Okay, well, what next? Like, what other drugs are in development?" And he said, "There aren't any other drugs in development." I said, "Okay, well, what sort of promising leads are there? Are there cell types? Are there, like, things that we can target?" And he said, "No, there aren't." And within just a couple minutes, I went from being this really optimistic Penn Med student who was back to fighting cancer and who just hoped and prayed that this drug would work, to realizing that this drug was not going to work for me and that I was out of options.
It was David's 4th relapse, and what would maybe become his most important lesson yet. If he wanted a cure, he'd have to find it himself.
If I was going to hope for a drug or pray for a solution, that I would need to turn my hope into action, and that I would need to start fighting back and start to try to identify drugs and treatments that could maybe help me and other patients.
So David dove into the research and pretty quickly realized there was a problem. There were just a handful of Castleman's researchers around the world, and none of them were talking to each other. As one of David's friends told him, what Castleman's needed was a quarterback. And that's something David knew how to do. Back in Philadelphia, he launched a 2-pronged campaign. Along with his doctor, Fritz Van Rie, he created the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, a foundation dedicated to connecting Castleman's researchers and facilitating the development of new drugs. At the same time, he threw himself into laboratory and clinical research, using himself as a subject. Illness aside, it was a fertile year for David. He graduated from medical school and got engaged to Caitlin, was pushing forward his own research and cultivating a global Castleman's community. He was starting to feel hope. And then, once again, the symptoms returned. Fatigue, abdominal pain, night sweats, all the same as before. They should have been easy for David to recognize. But this time, he just couldn't.
I was still in denial. I was like, you know, it can't be a relapse. I've only been fighting this, you know, working on treatments and trying to identify something else for about a year. And like, I haven't made enough progress yet. Like, this can't be it. I need more time.
David was virtually out of treatment options. There were no more experimental drugs for him to take, and he was approaching the lifetime maximum of the heavy-dose chemotherapy that had saved him in the past. And worse than all that, an important deadline was looming.
Then at this stage, I was engaged to Caitlin, and I wanted to make it to our wedding date more than anything. It was 5 months from our wedding date, and that's all I could think about. I could just make it to May 24th, 2014.
In the end, the high-dose chemotherapy again served to tide him over. But David knew it was just a temporary fix. The clock was running down, and he needed a Hail Mary pass if he was going to survive.
And then I really dove into my data. I dove into the samples that I had, the experiments I'd been running, the data that I'd been generating, to try to identify some sort of signal within the data that could maybe identify a drug that already existed. I knew I couldn't develop a new drug. That would take 10 years and $1 billion, but maybe I could find something in my data that would suggest that something was wrong, where there was a drug that already exists that could target that thing.
Over the next few weeks, David pored over thousands of pages of his own medical records, along with data from the experiments he'd done with himself as the subject. What he was looking for was a tell, that one irregularity that might be the key to his illness. It was like finding a needle in a haystack. And then, one day, he spotted it. In data taking several months before his last relapse, he saw that his T cells and a specific immune system molecule were out of whack. After more tests, David figured out the connection between the two, a cellular communication line called the mTOR pathway. David had a hunch that if he was able to shut down that communication line, he might be able to prevent his immune system from overreacting.
But I knew that there was a drug called sirolimus, and this drug was developed 30 years ago for kidney transplantation. It had never been used before for Castleman disease. But I was out of options, and so I decided to try it on myself as the first patient with Castleman's.
David took the leap. In January of 2014, he quit taking his other drugs and started taking sirolimus. It was a gamble, but one that ultimately paid off.
Today, it's now been almost 71 months. I think it's like 71.92 months. I can't round up. I don't know if I'm going to make it to 72 months. But I also won't round down because, you know, we worked really, really hard for each portion of this remission.
These days, he leads a research lab at the University of Penn, where he went to medical school. And he and Caitlin have a daughter, 1.5-year-old Amelia, who's just starting to walk.
Walk to Eddie. Walk here. Walk here. You can do it.
David ended up turning his experimental cure into a clinical study. So far, it's shown that sirolimus helps 30% of patients go into remission. It's a major win, but for David, not quite enough.
We constantly have patients come into our lab reminding our team of, you know, why we do what we do. And, you know, all I have to do is touch my chest and feel my port, which is where I get chemotherapy, to remind me, like, things feel really, really good and I'm doing really, really well right now. But I know where I've been and I know what's kind of below the surface. And so that just motivates me to keep working harder and harder and harder.
But now at least there's a roadmap for how to find them. There's the research being done by the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, and of course, there's David's own Hail Mary approach, the discovery of which helped deliver David's fifth and final lesson.
With this fifth time I nearly died, I think the biggest lesson that I took from it is that solutions can sometimes be hiding in plain sight. This drug that I'm on was in my nearby neighborhood CVS for all of those years when I was in and out of the hospital, spending months hospitalized, but no one had ever thought to try it. This drug was just sitting there on the shelf. Of course, behind the counter, it's a prescription drug, but no one had thought to try it. How many other drugs are there out there? How many other solutions are there out there for diseases and for other industries where they already exist, just someone has to find it?
That story was reported by Liz Tong. Our show today is about new goals and missions for a new year. And we asked scientists what they are hoping to do differently this year.
I'm John Epstein. I'm the chief scientific officer at Penn Medicine. I'm excited about the possibility that scientists are learning how to read a new language, and that's the language of the immune system. And when I think about this, I think about my old car, which I used to have to bring into the shop to put meters into it to test things. And then I think about my wife's new car, a Tesla, that she can look at her iPhone and see what the temperature is and what it's doing from miles and miles away, because it has sensors in it that sense all sorts of different aspects. And I think what we're learning is that the immune system is our own internal sensor. We just don't know how to read it fully yet. It's telling us whether we have disease, whether we're sick, whether we have cancer. And if we only learned how to read it, even read it remotely, we would know a lot more about our own health. And I think we are learning how to boost it and improve immune health, even how to engineer it so it can attack disease. And I think this next frontier about really learning how to read the language of the immune system is going to transform medicine.
How will you read my immune system? Is it a blood test? Do you look at my counts, my numbers? What are the red flags you're looking for?
I think it's both going to be blood tests and also imaging tests that can image immune cells. But, I'm a doctor, and the tests we use regularly in the hospital now to look at your immune system are the same ones I learned in medical school, 40 years ago. We haven't come that far. And yet, in the research world, scientists can read thousands or even millions of parameters of the immune system in the laboratory. So we need to apply that to medical care.
Coming up, can scientists drastically reduce air travel and still do their work?
I can taste success. Like, I feel so strongly that we can achieve the changes that we need to achieve without sacrificing what is most essential.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about new missions and visions as we head into a new year. For many scientists, the issue they want to focus on in 2020 is climate change. For example, we talked to Samantha Chapman. She's a biology professor at Villanova University in Pennsylvania. She studies mangroves. And she told us there has to be a shift from preservation efforts to helping ecosystems adapt to climate change. She's starting a new center to help international scientists collaborate on this problem.
And the idea is that we have people discovering lizards in Namibia and working in the Delaware Bay on marshes and all over the world working in different things, but they're all focused on this stewardship of the Earth that is becoming pretty pressing. And I think this has kind of come about because there's been just some grief among the various scientists that are working in systems where they're seeing things go extinct and our coastal systems being flooded by sea level rise. And so we sort of had the idea of coming together and creating the center to figure out, number one, how to better communicate our science, but also using tools that, let's say, someone working on lizards uses for bioinformatics or statistics, and then I could potentially use that in my mangrove ecosystems I'm working on, since we don't know each other's tools that well. So I don't know. At this point, it's a lot of conversations, but we just launched it, and that's my goal for 2020.
Scientists want to be part of the solution when it comes to climate change, and their work tends to involve travel, specifically air travel, to research sites, to conferences, and that means they're contributing to the problem by putting tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Is there a way around this? Alan Yu reports.
A few years ago, climate scientist Nader Jivanji had just gotten his PhD.
So that's, an early stage of your career. And, of course, you want to establish yourself and you want to make sure that people know you and they know your work. And so for that, it's important to go to conferences.
Welcome to today's explorations of the future science.
And he went to a lot of conferences. He would go to 4, sometimes 5 a year. And this is important work for scientists and academics. They go to conferences to tell people what they're working on, find out what everyone else is doing, meet collaborators, look for jobs.
I remember one year trying to cast a wide net and saying to myself, well, You know, there's a meeting of earth scientists in Europe, in Vienna.
He decided to go.
But at the same time, I've got small kids, and I didn't want to be away from them for too long. So it was a week-long conference. I didn't even go for the whole week. I think I stayed maybe 3 nights. Made the flight out there, gave my 15-minute presentation, you know, went out to dinner, I went and saw some talks.
It went well. He got what he wanted. But on the way back, something didn't feel right.
I was just struck by the extravagance of it all. The expense of the travel, the distance traveled, the short time that I was there.
He thought of the book Being the Change from fellow climate scientist Peter Kalmus about traveling slow, flying less to reduce carbon emissions, but also to savor the journey. The carbon footprint of flying can be as much as 3 times as doing the same trip by train. A researcher in Norway calculated the carbon footprint of scientists in his organization traveling for business. He found that just their business travel of 24 days produces more carbon dioxide than the global average of how much people produce in a whole year. Nader thought he should not go to as many conferences and pledged to fly less. There was a conference in Greece last year that's exactly about his work, the physics of clouds and climate change, but this time he did not go. Instead, he'll go next year when the same conference will be in the US, so maybe he could take the train. This is definitely new among academics.
Feels to me, yeah, like a little bit of a tectonic shift where the ground shifts in a somewhat profound way.
One of the people behind this movement is Park Wilde, a food economist at Tufts University. He started a blog and a petition dedicated to getting academics to fly less.
I can taste success. Like, I feel so strongly that we can achieve the changes that we need to achieve without sacrificing what is most essential.
In favor of the petition are roughly 600 academics and a handful of universities or associations. The goal is not to shame people for flying. The goal is for people to think carefully about whether they need to fly, and for universities and professional associations to track and report the carbon footprint of flying.
Colleagues will immediately start to think of the flights that they've taken that were most important, either for their career or for the good that they do in the world. Imagine, here in the nutrition school at Tufts University, I have colleagues who work on international hunger issues, and some flight that they take may be involved in saving many lives. Clearly, that is not the flight to give up.
Some colleagues also question whether one person can actually make a difference by giving up one flight. It's not like the plane is going to stay on the ground just because some professors didn't buy tickets. Hannah Knox has thought about this a lot.
It either falls into it being a matter of personal choice and an individual decision, or seen as not really relevant because what we should really be doing is looking at the structural changes that need to be made to society as a whole.
She's an anthropologist at University College London, and she had given up flying for an entire year. Part of her research is about how scientists and activists reduce their carbon footprints. Some people have already worked on alternatives. Anand Pandian, an anthropologist at Johns Hopkins University, organized a rather unique panel last November of a conference of the American Anthropological Association in Vancouver.
Welcome, everyone, to Reimagining the Annual Meeting.
Instead of people flying from across the world to be in the same room, he asked panelists to put up short videos of their presentations so people could watch and discuss online.
Someone described it, I remember quite distinctly, as one of the best binge-watching experiences in anthropology.
This was more than just turning conferences into anthropology Netflix. For a previous conference, Anand also helped organize local watch parties, so you could talk about the material with other anthropologists in your area. Anand says he did all this partly because of climate change, and partly because flying to conferences raises other barriers. For example, traveling to conferences is great if you have the money to fly, are able-bodied, and can afford to leave your family alone for a few days to meet your colleagues. But what about academics who can't do that? He gave one example of someone attending for the very first time.
Someone noted on Twitter, for example, that this was the first American Anthropological Association panel that they'd ever be attending. They wrote this from Karachi, having never thought it'd be possible to actually tune in to any panel at this conference because it was simply too far to travel.
And then he gave another example.
One of the most poignant presentations during that panel was made by a graduate student at Oregon State University who's undocumented and who's in fact studying the condition of undocumented migrants to the United States.
Mi nombre es Argenis Hurtado Moreno, and I am a DACA beneficiary. I was born in Michoacán, Mexico, and came to the U.S. at the age of 3, up until 2012 when the Obama administration...
Because the conference took place across the border between the United States and Canada, he was unable to cross the border to present in person.
Anand has the data and can see that people watched this particular panel from all around the world.
Philippines, South Africa, Greece, Colombia, Spain, Indonesia, Ethiopia, Denmark, Austria, Brazil. There are scholars in our field scattered literally all around the world. And I think if we were a little more open-minded about what it would take to bring them into conversations like this, we might find that we are actually growing our numbers with regard to those who might participate and share.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're talking about new goals and missions as we head into a new year. What can we learn from people who have found new paths? 10 years ago, Scott Fedor felt like he was on top of the world. He was a vice president of a successful company.
Happily married and looking forward to spending July 4th weekend with my wife and her family at their cottage.
Scott decided to walk down to the dock and go for a swim in the lake.
As soon as I dove in the water, my head slammed into the lake bed with such force that I knew right away what had happened. I lost all movement suddenly. Just remember laying in the water and floating face down, fully conscious, realizing that I had just broken my neck. I vividly remember my heart beating so fast and so loud that I thought a heart attack was imminent, that my heart was literally going to explode in my chest. And I said some prayers and just remember being overcome with a tremendous sense of guilt. I felt extremely guilty that I had ruined not just my life, but the life of those who loved me. And that guilt was replaced with fear and sadness, realizing that I was going to die alone, wet and paralyzed, in a lake somewhere up in Michigan. There was no one who saw me dive in. No one knew what had happened. And to not prolong the inevitable, that's when I decided to swallow the water, to drown.
But the family dog had followed Scott down to the lake and alerted everybody. Scott was rescued and taken to the hospital. His injuries were so severe it took hours of surgery to try to stabilize his spine and body. But when he woke up, the news was bad.
I would never walk again, never spend a long time out of bed again, never be able to breathe on my own, eat or swallow again.
Because he wasn't able to breathe on his own, Michigan's death with dignity laws meant that Scott had a right to end treatment and his life.
They could stop with the artificial life support and allow me to just simply die and expire, as they put it.
And did you want to, quote, expire? I mean, what a weird word, right?
Right. It's shocking that I chose to live when when the doctors had given me that choice. I wasn't one of those individuals who realized that all of a sudden this trauma had happened and said, okay, you know what, I'm going to suck it up and I'm going to move forward. I was severely depressed, just constantly in a state of anxiety and uncertainness. I still couldn't really comprehend what had happened. And when I was given that choice at that moment, for whatever reason, you know, I believe it, there was some divine intervention at that moment, because there was just a voice that came into my head and said, yes, I want to live.
Scott chose life, but that came at a price. He had to relearn how to do everything.
Pretty much just like a baby, you know, like a brand new infant, except I couldn't even cry loud because I had lost that ability. I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't move anything. I couldn't breathe on my own.
I'm wondering if this accident stripped everything away from you. And, you know, when we go about our regular life, there are all these distractions. There's our careers and our friends and our partners. And it sounds like what happened to you just brought everything down to only what was inside of you. So it was this very distilled conversation with yourself that you had to have without anything else. Nothing else could distract you from finding out what's at your core.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, when the doctors, the nurses, the family, you know, they would leave for the night, it would just be me laying in that bed with the sound of beeping machines and the thoughts in my head. And you have a lot of reflection on kind of where you've been in your life. And then a lot of guessing and anticipation, or I should say just uncertainty about where things are going to go. And I had so many conversations with myself during those nights, and really having to look deep and kind of deciding, okay, can I do this? Do I want to do this? And how am I going to do this? I started to approach things just one little victory at a time, not looking for that home run swing to get out of bed and walk tomorrow, but things like, okay, learning how to breathe on my own without a ventilator, learning how to sit up in a chair and tolerate it all day. So it was just all these little victories that I tried to focus on and celebrate, no matter how small they were. And as I started amassing little victory after victory, my mind started to convince my body that, okay, you can do this. Yes, it's tough and things are going to still be tough, but you're achieving these little milestones.
After 6 months, Scott was released from the hospital, but there were more roadblocks ahead.
I went into a nursing home, and here I was living in an environment surrounded by people that were there to kind of live out their final days. And I was this early 30, kind of young go-getter, and it was just the worst environment I could find myself in.
Yeah.
And the one thing that kept me going every day was my physical therapy. It gave me hope. And one day that therapy was discontinued by my insurance. And I remember at that very moment in time just thinking how awful this is. The one thing that's making me feel like I can go on has now been taken away from me. And I thought, you know what, this just isn't right.
Scott had family and friends who helped him pay for the therapy that he needed, but he was thinking about others out there who didn't have those kinds of resources, and he decided to start a foundation, Getting Back Up. It's a nonprofit that raises money for people with spinal cord injuries like his.
And I always tell people when I'm meeting new injured people, doctors are very good at telling you what's going on right now, but they're not soothsayers. They can't predict the future. They can't see what's inside of your mind or your attitude. You know, an x-ray and an MRI can't see the human spirit or the will of the individual. So you still control your attitude, and your attitude can shape your well-being in more ways than one may realize.
Scott says this work, this new life, has been really rewarding for him.
What I have found in my life and what I have gotten in return as a result of losing everything is nothing short of a miracle to me. That has brought me so much more fulfillment than I ever thought it would. I wake up every day with a fire in my belly to want to get through the day and accomplish as much as I can, help people the way I can. I find that fire is always burning within me. I feel I have a mission in life, a clear mission, and a vision of how I want to accomplish that.
Scott Fedor is the author of Headstrong, How a Broken Neck Strengthened My Spirit. His organization that helps people with spinal cord injuries is called Getting Back Up. On this episode, we're hearing from people who have found a new vision or mission for themselves. For Gordon Melvin, the inspiration to change his life came from PBS, public television, watching a yoga program with Priscilla Patrick.
Drop the hips, and then your legs are going to go straight up in the air. Do not let the knees bend. Easing down one vertebra at a time, all the way down. Easy. Easy.
At the time, Gordon's life had hit rock bottom. He was in prison on drug charges, and he decided to finally turn his life around. Gordon was interviewed by Spoon Jackson for the KALW series Uncuffed. At the time of the interview, both men were incarcerated in California Solano State Prison.
Inhale, expand upwards. Exhale, forward fold. Inhale, halfway lift, hands on shins. Exhale, hands to the floor, stepping all the way back.
It's important to take deep breaths when you do yoga, right?
Absolutely.
So it's important to take deep breaths now, right?
Absolutely. My name is Gordon Alexander Melvin.
Thank you.
And I am Canadian. Incarcerated in California.
How long?
23 years right now. Okay.
So how did you get started in doing yoga?
I got started about 2003. I'd just been involved in another riot, and that was on over here on what used to be called One Yard. It's A Yard now.
Yeah.
So we were locked down again, and I was tired, beat up. My back was messed up, and one time after an alarm on the yard, I had to roll over on my stomach, do a push-up to get up. Mm. I couldn't stand straight up. And somebody told me, oh, you got tight hamstrings. And me being me, I thought, this guy's a nut. Mm-hmm. What's tight hamstrings got to do with a sore back? But I never forgot what he said. And so when I started with Priscilla, I started noticing a little benefit. My back wasn't quite as sore. My hamstrings weren't as tight. I could bend over and touch my shins. Prior to that, I could barely touch my knees.
Yeah, so yoga is a powerful exercise, but at the same time, it's tender, and you be gentle to your body as you doing the stretches and stuff. That's what you said?
First precept of yoga is ahimsa, nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And I was not practicing nonviolence.
What do you mean?
I was violent with myself and still, drugs, substances. The way I practiced yoga, I was still involved in fights. I was still got involved in a couple more riots. And then 2006, one morning I was done. I was so disgusted with myself. It was either change or kill myself. Want to do another one? Inhale up. Exhale, forward fold. Inhale, halfway lift. Exhale, those hands down, stepping all the way back. So I really got into this, the precepts. It was almost like a monkish existence. When I finally agreed to doing downward dog in public, we just did here.
Yeah.
It was under the TV in the day room.
Under the TV in the day room in a prison?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was quite a...
What kind of looks you were getting?
It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Overcoming self-conscious, that's one of the biggest fights we have within ourselves.
Yeah.
It's all about us, right? People are looking at us. People are looking at us. But the thing is... In a room full of people doing down dog, no one's looking at you.
Yeah, and being in a prison is even more, everything is 10 times magnified. They see a bunch of guys with their ass in the air. Yeah. And some guys say, well, that's not kosher. That's not cool. That's not, you know, to have your ass in the air in a prison. But the more enlightened, the more aware people, the more people that take into their growing and becoming a richer human being going to say, well, I'll try it, and then if I get benefits from it, I'll keep doing it.
Kim Young, she was associate warden here at the time.
Yeah.
She was a big-time yogi. Started supporting us, and then she put together this cancer walk. I believe it was 2011 or 2012.
Yeah.
And asked us if we'd do it on the yard.
If you would do what?
Perform yoga in the yard.
Yeah.
Run a yoga sequence.
And where does she want you to do this yoga?
We ended up doing it on the handball court, and that was just the coolest experience. 30 guys from all different cliques and gangs.
Yeah, black, white, Mexican.
Everybody, yeah, doing yoga on the handball court that
United
day.
Nations all with and, their ass in there.
And right then I realized that yoga was an equalizer. Everybody was equal.
I want to take yoga. I got somebody I'm want to teach it to me, but I'm not ready to put my ass in the air yet.
The heart center. Inhale, expand upwards. Exhale, forward fold. Inhale, halfway lift, hands on shins. Exhale, hands to the floor, stepping all the way back and coming all the way down. Inhale, up into cobra. Exhale, down dog.
Gordon Melvin was interviewed by Spoon Jackson for the KALW series Uncuffed, which can be found in podcast players. Thanks to Eli Wirtschafter for production help. Gordon is free now and living in Canada. He recorded this message.
Hello, everybody. My name is Gordon Melvin, formerly K22673. That's right, formerly. I was released April 10th. ICE kicked me loose in the international terminal of the Edmonton Airport. No money, no ID, and terrified. If I hadn't had family waiting for me, it could have got rough in that I hadn't been home to Canada in 30-plus years. But they were there to pick me up. Now, just because I left CDCR don't mean I stepped off the yoga mat either. Nope, yoga is part of my life and always will be. As a starving student, I don't have the funds necessary to pay for a teacher's certification, nor the time to commit to it. But this is definitely one of my future goals. This doesn't prevent me from working with individuals when asked. I do. I'd like to close by encouraging you all and your families to keep the faith. Your turns will come as long as you continue to work for it. One more thing before I go. Try stepping onto a yoga mat. It might change your life like it did mine. I'm sitting on mine right now recording this, and I thought that was appropriate. Be good now. Namaste.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. By the way, we put together a list of our favorite episodes from last year. Hope you check it out. It's on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jets Lehman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.